Kate Remington, and I'm with Ryan Eich. And, you know, it's just so cool to reconnect after the Game Developers Conference. It's really fun to have a chance to talk again.
Yeah, and this is so neat to... Usually I do this in reverse, where if I give an interview of some kind and I get to meet the person later and kind of put the face to the voice, and it's cool to get to meet you first, and then I'm just excited to be here.
Yeah, and you've got just the most amazingly fun soundtrack for this hysterically funny game, West of Loathing.
Thank you.
It just, like, jumped out at me, and honestly, I hardly ever see a Polygon review score for a game that gets a 9, and you guys did.
No.
So congratulations. That's really cool.
Thank you. Yeah, we were pretty shocked as well, because that's... I like Polygon a lot. That's where I go for reviews for things, and they tend to reserve, like, 9s and actual 10s for things that they really like. They don't give them out that freely, and we were like, whoa. So... yeah, very neat.
Yeah, I mean, clearly you guys were onto something. And this is done by the same studio that made Kingdom of Loathing. So, you know, it's clearly not their first rodeo, asymmetric games. But they're just a little team. And so how did you get this gig writing the music for them?
So every time somebody asks me how I get a particular gig and I tell them, it just sounds like the universe is this cosmic accident when you're working in game audio, which it pretty much is. But, like... basically what happened is I did music for a game called Frog Fractions 2 that was made by a guy named Jim Crawford. And he is friends with the Asymmetric guys and does a podcast with them called Video Games Hot Dog. And I believe through him, he kind of was talking me up to them a little bit, but they ended up reaching out to me because they were starting work on West of Loathing, and they reached out to me kind of through him. But it's one of those things where, like, if I hadn't gotten game A, which caused me to meet Jim at PAX and then caused me to score his game, which caused me to do this one, it's just kind of like one of those things that happens to a lot of game audio people, I imagine, where these projects just kind of chained into me meeting new people and getting to work with them, which is definitely how I prefer to do it, over, like, leaving a stack of business cards on a toilet tank somewhere.
Yeah, because then you never know who's going to pick those up, so...
Right, yeah, I get a lot of solicitations and not the kind I'm looking for.
Well, the thing that really struck me about being at GDC is seeing just what a tight-knit community game audio people and game composers in particular are. And so it seems like once you become part of that group, boy, you know, there are a lot of opportunities, which is just so cool.
There are, and it's I tell a lot of people who are trying to get into this career, like, that... It's worth it because the game audio community is one of the coolest communities of people I've ever run into. Like, I've met literally, I think, zero composers and sound designers in game audio. I'm sure they exist somewhere, but I've met none who are jerks. And it's just because they kind of get drummed out. Like, they don't make it because this community is so positive and inclusive. And we give each other gigs regularly, which is nice. Like, I've had people ask me, like, well, why are you helping this game audio person, you know, like, get noticed? Like, aren't they your competition? And it's just kind of like, I mean, I guess, but, like, they'll probably hook me up at some point too. It's not worth it to, we're not a very competitive group. like musicians can't be bothered to, like, get to the bank before it closes. So we don't have the energy to, like, do some Game of Thrones nonsense on each other. Like, we just want to make music.
Well, yeah. And Marty O'Donnell said one of his like golden rule is first do no annoying. And that way doors will open and you'll keep your friends and get those gigs. And so, it's just such a great community. And I'm kind of the beneficiary of that, too, because anytime I ask somebody like you if you want to be on the series, you're like, yeah, sure. So so it's just a really inclusive, really positive group of people, which is fantastic.
Totally.
We'll be right back.
this game, West of Loathing, I was laughing playing it. It's just unbelievably funny. And so maybe we should just describe it a little bit for people who aren't familiar with it. It looks like a really simple game, but it's not. I mean, there's stick figures and a really simple right. art style, but it's set out west, and so you've got all the tropes of, you know, west, you know, the Wild West movies, the spaghetti westerns, John Wayne kind of things. Mm-hmm. But the writing is brilliant. And so how soon into the process were you brought in to start with the music?
One of the reasons I really love working with Asymmetric, they've been like hands down one of the best teams I've ever worked with, is because they're like one of the only dev teams that I've personally worked with who brought audio in this early. And I'm not trying to slag off anyone else I'm working with. A lot of teams are very good about that, but like they brought me on, like they had some of the game ready, but nearly at the beginning of dev is when they reached out to me. And a lot of developers have this really kind of bad habit where they get to the point where they're like 2 weeks basically from shipping their game, and they're like, ah, crap, we forgot the music. And they do it super last minute, and that doesn't mean that a composer can't still do a good job, but they're limited now because they can't weave the music into the story and the characters from the beginning. It's just this thing that kind of gets bolted on at the end, and it's never going to be as good. And so I really appreciate they brought me on, you know, it's been, what, like 2 years, I think, ago now, two or two and a half that we've been working on this. And they brought me on pretty much right away, which rules. And, you know, if there's any devs listening, like, please do that, because your sound design and your music will be 1,000 times better if you get on it right away.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, as I said, it seems like a very simple game, and yet it's huge. There are like almost 100 locations and lots of puzzles and quests and NPCs that you can talk to, and these branching story trees and hats, lots of hats.
Heck yeah, for hats. Yeah, I think it's cool because their philosophy, and I can praise the how funny the game is all day, because I had nothing to do with that. I feel like they didn't waste an opportunity for a joke anywhere. Like, you almost never do something and don't get some dumb goof out of it. Like, even the menus have jokes. And I really appreciate that. Like, even I've played it 100 times now at this point, because, you know, playing through the developer build and stuff while we're working on it. And it still makes me laugh. Like, just because there's silly, like, goofs, like, everywhere, basically. Like, they don't miss an opportunity to put something like that in.
Yeah, well, so as they were working on the game and you were working on the music, how did you kind of come up with that really sort of ironic look at the iconic music from, like, the spaghetti westerns and the John Wayne thing? Did you sort of reverse engineer it and pull it all apart so you had, you know, those iconic sounds like the whistler and the bell and all of that stuff?
Yeah, so I'm a big Western fan. Like, I love that whole aesthetic and that genre. So, like, I had already heard a lot of, especially like Morricone stuff, of course, is like the go-to. I already heard a lot of those soundtracks and really kind of liked that aesthetic, and had been waiting to do a game that would let me do something like this for a long time. And so you kind of mentioned like reverse engineering it. Like, that's definitely what I did, is I knew a lot about the, because I'm a big music theory dork, and so I already kind of knew, like, how Western music functions, what chord progressions it uses, and intervals, and that sort of thing. But I wanted to make sure that I was really selling it, and so I kind of looked through, like, what are those iconic sounds, like you mentioned, that you get. You know, you get, like, somebody hitting an anvil, somebody cracking a whip, like, in the middle of a piece of music, like, those tubular bells. I bought a crappy harmonica at the Northgate Mall in Seattle. That I do not know how to play at all, but I was able to kind of, like, cheat it. There's a few tracks that have harmonica, like, just one lone kind of wavering note at the beginning, which is about the extent of my harmonica playing. But I wanted to have not so much a harmonica part, because that doesn't count, but just the idea of, I wanted to sell in players' minds that idea of that kind of Western aesthetic by using these iconic things that, you know, maybe if you ask the average person who watches Westerns, like, what kinds of things do you expect from the soundtrack? Like, they might also be calling out, like, oh, I want to hear, you know, like, the kind of crowd, like, chorus calls that they do and stuff, like Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And I want to hear whistling, and I want to hear, you know, like, whip cracks and stuff. So I tried to really sort out what would be those kind of You know, maybe it's cheap, but those kind of easy call-outs that make you immediately go, oh, this is a Western. My biggest problem with doing this soundtrack, my biggest kind of challenge that I hope worked out okay, is that this is a comedy game, right? And I wasn't sure, do I try to make the music funny also? Like, do I try to make it, like, over-the-top goofy? And I messed with that idea for a little bit at the beginning, like, doing that Western aesthetic but kind of more cartoony. And I felt like it didn't work because I think the jokes don't need any help from me, so I thought it was almost kind of funnier to have the music be almost like a straight man, have the music treat it like it's a really serious Western, so that with that playing in the background while you're doing all this dumb stuff, I hope that kind of helps to sell the humor a little bit more rather than going a more cartoony route with it.
Well, yeah, it absolutely does, because you don't, like you said, you don't want it to step on the really funny writing that's already in the game. And mm-hmm. I think comedy definitely works best if there is a straight man too. So, because then you've got a foil for all the humor. So, I think that was a really great choice.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, well, the other thing that I really appreciated about it is, because it's the art style is so simple with these adorable like stick figures, you kept the scale of the music like really in keeping with that too. And you know, you could have gone big. You've got all kinds of, you know, epic string samples and all of that stuff. But I think keeping it suited to the scale of the game was a really good choice too. Was that your original plan, or did you go through a few iterations before you got to that?
To be honest, it wasn't my original plan was to do this big, bombastic, you know, kind of thing. And I, on a few tracks, I feel like I still sort of approach that. Like the main theme that plays over the menu gets pretty big at the end and has like a chorus and stuff. But yeah, it just became one of those things. Again, this goes back to them hiring me on early, because one of my friends who's a sound designer says this really smart thing that I like, which is that you need to give your audio person time to fail with you. Because making video games is just making garbage over and over until it's not garbage anymore. and if you don't hire your audio person right away, they don't get the chance to fail iteratively with the rest of you. And so that's kind of what this allowed me to do, is I tried some bigger stuff. And I was like, this doesn't – when you're walking around town, like having this big booming kind of score doesn't really make any sense. But having like a lone kind of just wandering guitar does make sense. And so It was that kind of process where I tried bigger stuff and it just didn't fit how kind of charming and funny this world is supposed to be, and how it's really supposed to be focused more on like the character level. So yeah, that's why I ended up paring a bunch of stuff down and kind of making, you know, a lot of the tracks are more, you know, single or small ensemble type deal.
Yeah, there's one just called Set for a Spell, and I love the simplicity of it. Is that from the loading menu or just a kind of hanging out?
It's there are a few like quieter areas in the game, you know, where you're just walking around a ranch or something where you'll hear that. And that one was not supposed to be in the game at all. It's one of those cases where I forgot the rule that all audio people know, which is don't give your developers any temp music that you plan to replace later, because they will just use it. And then, so that's, and I'm not, you know, not throwing any shade at Asymmetric, because that was totally on me, but I had this track that was just labeled Sad Guitar, which became Set for Spell. And I thought I told them, but knowing me, I probably didn't remember to, that like, hey, this is just a temporary thing. It literally, like, I'm working on another game right now that uses a lot of folk and kind of Western-based music, and it literally was like a jacked melody from that game, like I stole from myself. And I was like, well, this won't be in the final game. This is just, we need something here right now, and I'll come back and write something else later. And then they used it in the game, and I was like, oh, crap. But we hadn't launched yet, so I had time to kind of change it and tweak it so that I wasn't ripping myself off and committing intellectual property theft against me and another game I work on. And so that's kind of where that one ended up coming from. I've had a lot of people say that they kind of dig that one, and it fits this weird phenomenon that I've noticed, at least with my soundtracks, where I am a tweaker. I will spend forever messing around with knobs and stuff till the very end. That kind of tweaker, not like I'm on crystal meth or something. Like that would be evident by now in the interview, I feel like. But I will mess with stuff till the very end, and I take, you know, however much time is presented to make a track is probably how much time I will use. But there always ends up being one song that just gets cram jammed in like a mad panic at the end. And that's always the one that people tend to like call out and respond to, which I don't get. And maybe I should change my process to just always do everything in a blind panic, because like Sad Guitar, or excuse me, Set for Spell, I'm still using the file name we had. Like, I've had a lot of people be like, hey, I really dig this one. It's like, yeah, I just kind of pulled it out of my butt at the end, but I'm glad that's working out.
I've heard from a lot of composers that, you know, a deadline is the best inspiration they can have.
It super is. Because you don't have that license anymore to mess around with stuff. Like people like me who will tweak and mess with it and go, well, it could always be a little better. Like, I'll just do that forever. But if I will get fired if I just don't hand something in, like, well, here you go. Hope you like it, because...
It's just step away from the keyboard and hit send. And
right.
So, yeah. The other one that I really, really loved is the Saloon song, the Sticks for Hands Rag. And, you know, you mentioned that the music itself isn't funny, but the titles are hysterically funny. And this.
Yeah, I'm trying a little Jason Graves type nonsense with that, because that's the only place I can actually write jokes in. You've seen the track listings for his like Dead Space soundtrack, right?
Yep.
they're incredible. Like, I left my heart in Surgery Bay 6 or whatever. Like, that's so good.
But that's way better than, you know, Scary Boss 2 or something like that. So,
no, totally.
But this one, the Sticks for Hands Rag, is great because, again, it just really captures the mood and the sound of Scott Joplin's classic Rag, which I absolutely love.
Thank you.
And so, again, I mean, did you spend a lot of time playing them so that you would get, you know, the way the harmony shifts and stuff, and they've got that kind of really wistful quality? Because you really captured that in this.
Thank you so much. Yeah, this is another one of those dumb bucket list things for me where, like, I love that moment in every Western where you go into a saloon and there's definitely, like, a piano player doing some kind of rag. And he's definitely probably going to get, like, punched in the back of the head when something, like, breaks out. But, like, that, I love that moment, and I'm so glad I got to do something like that.
Thank you.
So I am, my main instrument is piano. So when I was in high school and college, I definitely went through like a rag phase where I played a lot of Scott Joplin stuff, which I reviewed for this. And I'm glad you called out that harmony shift, because that was something like I really wanted to change keys a couple of times, and I want these different, like very distinct kind of rhythmic and melodic patterns like Scott Joplin would do all the time. And I hope that that came through. I also listened to kind of just refresh, a bunch of Debussy's Cakewalks, which are like proto rags, basically. And those are really good, too, for getting neat ideas, because hearing like a romantic expressionist era composer like doing this kind of almost goofy sounding march in the left hand with, you know, these really syncopated rhythms, and seeing his take on it was really cool too, because that gave me some other ideas on how to like mess with keys and mess with different rhythms and stuff. But yeah, I definitely did brush up on my old rag, my rag retention. I don't like the sound of that. That doesn't sound good. I don't know what rag retention is, but it doesn't sound great.
But yeah, you know, I did the same thing in like eighth grade or so. I got the great big book of Joplin rags and just sort of worked.
Heck yeah.
From it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I had that one.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, because in your session at GDC, which was really interesting, you talked about the importance of using real musicians as much as you can, even if you just have a tiny budget. So were you able to use some live musicians for this too?
I was a little bit. So this is actually one of those games where just the way things worked out, I had to be a little more kind of judicious. Kate, will you say the word I'm trying to say? Because apparently I'm...
Judicious.
That's the guy. God. Anyway, that. I was trying to be that. I don't know what's wrong with my face today. And I had to be a little more kind of careful with where I put live performers in, just because of the way, you know, budget and stuff is working out. And again, Asymmetric treated me very well in that regard. It was just more making sure that I was able to give the game what it needed in terms of live performers. But I did, I'm really happy about the main theme, that whistle that you hear at the beginning. That was originally me, and it sucked. Because I can't even whistle correctly. Like, I can literally only do it if I suck air in. Like, when I blow out, nothing happens. I'm like a child. So instead, I hired a friend of Kevin Simmons, who's one of the developers, this lady named Chelsea Greenwood, who has whistled like professionally, and she just warbles the bejesus out of it, and it's so good. And I just think she's a really good addition, and proof that like you don't need to hire necessarily like a concert horn player or a, you know, super gifted like guitar player. That's great. Those are good things to have for sure. But like, consider even like the smaller sounds, like hiring out. Like, this is just, she whistles for maybe a minute in one track, and then I don't think I use her again on the soundtrack, but I feel like it really sells that opening, because that's one of the first things you hear. So, you know, I did have to be a little more kind of precise about where I used live performers on this soundtrack, but I think I learned a cool thing about you can use live performers for even just small little items, and it can really kind of, I think, help to sell that particular track, even if it's just a smaller part.
Yeah, definitely. So as you're kind of planning the soundtrack and you're looking at the overview and the budget and everything and the kind of sound that you ultimately want, what kind of decisions do you have to make where you say, well, I really want a real instrument here instead of a sample? How do you go about doing that?
I think it's about figuring out where it's going to have the heaviest effect. Like, if you're using a live horn and it's part of a chorus of sampled horns, it can maybe help elevate that a little bit, but is it better to do it there on that track, or is it better to do it where it's a horn solo and the only thing you're going to hear is this live instrument? Or even more precise, you know, maybe just one section of one track where the horns are really singing out. You can have sampled everywhere else, but if you need to be more precise, maybe just hire the horn player for this one kind of little mariachi-style riff. So I think a lot of it was just really kind of looking at each track that I wanted to do and being like, okay, and this is unfortunately a thing a lot of other composers I know kind of at my level in the indie space have to do, you know, this thought process they have to go through is like, where can I get away with using the fake stuff, and where do I absolutely need to have live people? Ideally everything would be live, of course. But, you know, sometimes that's just not in the cards. And so I really kind of looked at like, okay, I want an actual horn here in this one part of the main theme. I need to have a real whistler because I suck at it. A lot of the live performances just on the soundtrack are just me. That was something I actually mentioned at our GDC talk. Me and Jacob Purnell, we talked about be your own resource. So if you can play even a little bit, like you're not great, but you can kind of get by on multiple instruments, that could be really helpful. So I told you about that harmonica I bought. That was me. There's some guitar picking that I'm terrible at guitar. Like I've had one for a decade and never learned it, but there's some kind of guitar accents that are me because I can, through the magic of editing, just like this podcast, make myself hopefully not sound stupid. But that was a lot of it. Just really trying to target like which tracks need this and which parts of those tracks, because it might not even be in the cards to hire somebody for an entire part.
Yeah, but you're right. It makes a huge difference because it really feels like, you know, people made this and people did this rather than just, you know, samples are great. And even, you know, composers working on AAA games use samples. But the trick is to make it sound like humans did this. And so so that's really, yeah. So how interactive did your score have to get with all these branching storylines and different characters and stuff?
So this is actually a soundtrack that's not as kind of dynamic as other ones that I've done, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing, but it is one of those scores that I've written where there's not quite as much kind of shifting levels like stuff that I've done on Gunpoint or other games that I've worked on where you want to have the music kind of shifting a lot. In this game, the music is more of kind of like a backdrop, like it's setting the tone and the emotional aesthetic of what's going on, and then hopefully that's playing off the humor in a way that works out. So I did have, like, I think the most interactive thing I got to do that I still think is really fun is there are these musicians you can find throughout the world that play, like, you know, one plays like washboard and one plays like upright bass, and you can put them all together and get them all to the Dirtwater Saloon where they can be on stage and they'll play together. But the song that you hear is not a like through composed piece of music. They're playing this kind of like blues, like jam band track. And the idea that Zach, the lead developer, and I had was that it'd be cool to do like blocks of music, like one or two measures each that would all kind of be not completely interchangeable, but that basically like the code would pick a random block for here's the first part of a blues song. Here's where you're hearing 1 to 4 to 1 to 1. And then here's another block that it selects from this other bin that like here's where we're going like 4 4 1 1, etc. And like it would build one pass through of a 12-bar blues by selecting random chunks of music that I'd made that fit each kind of particular section. So when you listen to that blues band in game, like you never hear them play it the same way every time because it's all kind of being cobbled together as it goes. So that was probably the most interactive thing I got to do, which was really fun.
Really cool. And again, you know, it adds to the replay value and all of that stuff, which is all.
Sure. We're all about that bullet point on the back of the box. Like, you can play this multiple times, I promise.
Well, now, you know, you've got some games under your belt. You've got some years of experience. And I'm just wondering, you know, you mentioned that you've had a lot of opportunities, partly from living in Seattle and partly because of going to school in San Francisco. But I'm wondering if you've got some suggestions or advice for composers who are like just getting started, or maybe they want to get started and they would love to hear from, you know, somebody who's in your position now where you're like some rungs up the ladder.
Sure. Yeah. So I just want to start off by saying that, like, when I was 4 years old, I ate an entire bar of Secret deodorant. So if I can do it, anybody can do it. I guess what I'm getting at. I'm really kind of passionate about this subject because I feel like there are a lot of people out there like me, like I was, who would love to do this but don't think it's practical or achievable. And I thought that for a long time. And even if you live kind of in the boonies, like that puts some challenges in your path, but you can do it. So what I recommend, if you don't already live kind of in Austin or the Bay Area or Seattle, which is, you know, the kind of bigger game industry hubs in America, that's okay. Because there's people who do game audio all over the country, and I know a lot of them who are very talented who live nowhere near a place like that. But what you should try to do, like the best way to start really getting work, and this is obviously goes in tandem with just building up your skills all the time. You should always try to be writing and try to be challenging yourself and be preparing for when you get that gig. But just try to target your resources that you do have. So I live here in Seattle. I can take a bus to get to PAX every year. It's like in my backyard, and that's a really great place to network and see people. But I also go to IndieCade and GDC and occasionally like E3. I went to Gamescom this year. These are all really great places to go and network and meet people in the games industry and make friends. It is ludicrous to assume that any one person should go to all of these, but I would recommend like try to target, like, I think I'm going to try to go to PAX this year. I'm going to try to go to GDC next year. And if you don't live near one of these places, just try to get out to when the entire industry gathers somewhere. You know, whatever you can afford, however you can make that work. It doesn't have to be every year if you can't do it, but really try to kind of make use of that time. And the number one thing I would say with networking when you go, because I hate that word,
yeah,
networking, like it's gross, right? It sounds like 80s like marketing speak, and it sucks. But I used to hate it because I thought you had to be like a sleazeball and be like pressing your card into people's hands and stuff, and I didn't want to do that. That's what I thought it was, and really what it is in this industry anyway, is just making friends. Like, it doesn't matter if it's devs or artists or other audio people, like literally just go and be your cool self and make friends, and it might seem like nothing happens, but, you know, give it a couple of weeks or months or even years down the line, like these friends that you've made will introduce you to other people who will become friends, and then some of those people might be looking for composers or sound designers, and you're not going to hire some guy who cold emails you, you know, out of the blue and kind of wants work. You're going to hire somebody you know and you like.
You're right. Meeting people and spending time with them is such a great way for them to get to know you. And then you're not starting cold. So I think that's super, right, super helpful. And Ryan, I know you've got some things in the pipeline, which I know I'll be able to talk with you about pretty soon. But wow, thanks so much. It's been really, really a lot of fun to catch up and talk again.
Yeah, I appreciate it. It's so cool to be on the show after, you know, having gotten to meet you at GDC last year. And, you know, I'm a fan, so it's neat to be here.